This is Grow in Grace, a daily teaching ministry of Palmetto Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina. The prophet Elijah was a very obedient prophet. God sent him to confront a powerful, evil king, and he went. When God told him to confront wicked priests, he did. How did Elijah grow a living faith that was so obedient to God? Well, today, Pastor Sam Horn will continue a sermon titled, God's Friend, Elijah's Prayer. Let's listen together so we can grow in grace.
You know, you may feel like you're not somebody very special. You don't have a long history. Your family genealogy is not one that you would be super proud of. Your lineage is not filled up with great servants of God. You are just a humble, ordinary, everyday, unknown person, and you wonder if God even knows who you are and where you are. You know theologically that he does. You know that in your head, but sometimes you wonder, Lord, I've just been serving you in this place. I'm really a nobody. And that's Elijah. He was an ordinary, humble, obedient, faithful servant. And that's the key. He was faithful. By the time you get to that monumental moment in Elijah's life, he says this, I want you to answer my praying, Lord, so that everybody will know that everything I have been doing according to your word. That's in 1836. He was obedient and he was faithful. He was wholehearted in his approach to God. He was a wholehearted, single-focused, fully trusting servant. Whatever God told him to do, Elijah just went and did it. We're not told about his internal feelings until we get to chapter 19. All we're told is that when God told this man to do something, this man went and did it no matter what. When he said, listen, Elijah, I want you to go to the most powerful man in the kingdom because I have something I want you to say to him, Elijah went. When God said to him, Elijah, I want you to go to this brook and I want to take care of you there and I'm going to send a raven, Elijah could have said, whoa, hang on a second. I am your prophet. I am a good Jew. You're sending an unclean bird to feed me? That's going to make me unclean. Elijah didn't do any of that. He just went and did exactly what God told him to do. And then when God said to him, listen, I actually want to take you from the brook and I want you to go right into the middle of Jezebel's home area. I want you to go right into her territory where she came from. There's a widow there that I'm going to use to feed you and sustain you. And I want you to go and I want you to meet this widow. Elijah gets up and he goes. You have a long history in these chapters of a very ordinary, humble, everyday person listening to God and doing exactly what God told him to do. He had been listening to God and he had been obeying God for a long time before he ever stood on that mountain and called fire down from heaven. And you know there's a pattern there for us, isn't there? That oftentimes as God gets us ready for that moment in our life that he has put us on the planet to do, there is often a lifetime before of God getting us ready for that one moment by reminding us and helping us and encouraging us and correcting us so that we do what this ordinary, everyday, humble servant of God did. We do exactly what God tells us to do. And sometimes when we don't, God is so gracious to correct us. We're going to find that this happens in Elijah's life in chapter 19. Elijah, after this monumental victory, basically says, I'm done. It is enough. In other words, if you could put it in our language, after this monumental period of time, an extended period of time of difficult service to God in a hard place and in a dark space, and after seeing all that God did, there came a moment in Elijah's life when you find him by himself out in the middle of a desert under a tree, and he's throwing up his hands to God, and he's literally saying to God, I'm done. I've had enough. You ever been there? I'm done. It's enough. I'm tired. This isn't changing. This is exhausting. Your people aren't responding. I've done what I've done. And God, I'm just all in. I am done. It is enough. I've been there. Truth is, you've been there. Some of you may be there right now. You've had a season of unbearable difficulty, but unbeknownst to you, it's been probably one of the most fruitful seasons in your life. You just haven't seen the fruit yet. And in the middle of all of that, you threw your hands up and you told the Lord, I am done. Enough. And the God who sent fire on Mount Carmel could have easily sent fire on his servant, but he didn't. He came down and he graciously ministered to his servant, restored his servant, returned his servant. Elijah's life is the story of a man just like us. But if you read that life, it's amazing. There are five stunning miracles that are just unbelievable that God uses Elijah to bring about in Israel during his time here. The only prophet who has more miracles than Elijah is Elisha, who has 10 miracles that are recorded in the narrative. And you'll remember that when Elijah went up to heaven, Elisha's one request was, I want a double portion, and he gets a double portion. And it's laid out for you in evidence of the 10 miracles that happened in Elisha's life. So how in the world did this ordinary, humble, faithful, tired, sometimes discouraged servant of God accomplish what he accomplished? He did it the same way that God's servants today do what they do for the Lord. He did it by the power of God's Spirit and by fervent praying. And that's exactly how you and I are going to do what God calls us to do. God sent a nobody. God reached down and tapped a nobody and said to him, I have something I want you to do. But this nobody had been doing something. It wasn't like the nobody was just sitting around waiting for this magic moment when God was going to tap him on the shoulder and say, hey, pal, get off the bench. I'm putting you in. We're going to run these series of plays, and we're going to win the game. That's not what happened. This faithful servant of God had been doing something for a long time as he watched what was going on around him. You know what he'd been doing? James says he had been praying fervently. He had been praying fervently. Before we ever get to the opening sort of announcement in chapter 17, verse 1, this servant had been doing something. He had been praying fervently. There had been this consistent, passionate praying that had come out of this humble, everyday, ordinary person living in Israel, living in the northern kingdom, watching all of this idolatry, watching all of this immorality, watching all of this outward success deceive God's people into a path that was going to lead them to death. And here is one individual, one ordinary, everyday, common person, and he was talking to God about all of this. And one day, in the midst of all of that conversation, God said to him, I want you to go to somebody because I'm going to start talking. So who's the somebody that Elijah is sent to? And you know this somebody as Ahab. Ahab, the son of Omri. Listen to how he's introduced into the storyline. Listen in 1 Kings chapter 16. Listen to how the writer wants you to think about Ahab. Ahab, the son of Omri, first thing you hear is this. Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord. And just so you get it, he did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And then it's even worse, verse 31. And as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and he went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria, and Ahab made an Asherah. This is the female consort of this god Baal. And then here's what you find. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. Here's the somebody. He's a very well-known person. He is the son of a powerful king named Omri, who had restored the kingdom in the north to its political and military and economic position. And Ahab inherited all of this, and because of his own political acumen and his own military ability and his own leadership and economic savvy, he was able to take this kingdom even further into prosperity than his father had. In fact, he was so well known internationally that King Shalmaneser III, a very famous Assyrian king who lived at the same time, actually wrote about Ahab in his records. Ahab was well known. He was powerful. He was respected. But God says, I want you to know something about Ahab. He was wicked. He was immoral. And he married through a political alliance the daughter of a very powerful king. And when that daughter came to Israel, she brought her gods with her. She brought Baal, the storm god. She brought Ashtaroth, the god of fertility. And those two gods would partner together, and they were the gods responsible in the eyes of the pagan world for bringing rain and bringing harvest to the land. And Jezebel was not content just to come into Israel as Ahab's wife and have a place where she could have her own worship. She wanted her worship to replace the worship that had been in Israel from the time of Moses. Really, from the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which is why Elijah keeps calling the entire nation back to Abraham and back to Isaac and back to Israel, back to Jacob. Because here is a woman that brings 450 priests of Baal into this little country called Israel, and 400 priests of the female consort. You say, why did she need so many of them? Because it was their job to teach Israel how to worship these two gods. And they did. They had propagated the worship of two false gods in the very heart of God's people, and God's people, the monies that were coming in from God's people that fed Ahab's coffers, were the monies that he was using to take care of these prophets. They sat and they ate at the king's table. And what that means is that the king was using state money, state funds, to fund all of this idolatry in the land. It is an incredible picture if you stop and think about it. In fact, it was so wicked in the land that there's a detail given to you in chapter 16 when God says about Ahab, he did more wickedly than any king before him. There was a high-ranking Israelite who decided to disregard the prophecy that God had made about Jericho. Remember Jericho? When we read about Rahab earlier in James, and we talked about this very first city in this pagan land, Canaan, that God was sending his people into, that was filled up with idolatry and immorality. And the chief city that represented all of that was Jericho. And in an act of judicial judgment, God decreed that that city be destroyed and never be rebuilt. But in the days of Ahab, there was a high-ranking Israelite who decided, you know, that prophecy, we don't have to pay attention to that. That's a choice piece of terrain. That was a powerful city at one point, and he decided to rebuild it. And when he laid the foundations of that city, he had a ceremony. He had an incredible, atrocious ceremony. He sacrificed his first son and put his first son into those foundations. And at the end, when he had rebuilt the city and he was dedicating the gates of that city, he sacrificed his youngest son. And if you go back to the prophecy, it's all there. Here is a king who threw off all restraint, who led God's people into this kind of disregard for the wisdom from above so that they could embrace the wisdom that Jezebel brought from below. And the entire land had been impacted by this. He did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all of the kings of Israel who were before them. You know, folks, as you think about life in our day and age, we're not too far away from this. I'm not trying to spiritualize this. We do have to be careful about how we look at Old Testament texts and how we transport their truth. But realistically, spiritually, we're not too far away from a time like the time we're reading about, where God's people, even God's people, are casting off restraint. Even God's people are looking at things that God has said and say, well, you know, that actually probably isn't for us, and we can just go out and do whatever we want. And here in all of this was a nation that had been led whole hog into idolatry and whole hog into immorality. And they stood in danger of spiritual judgment that was about to fall on their head. But God had another plan. And I'll play the card early. The card is this: God had decided to restore his people and to bring them to repentance. And so he tapped this nobody who had been praying fervently, and he said, I want you to go to somebody, and when you get there, I want you to tell everybody a message that I have. So he comes to Ahab, and he walks in at 17:1, and there's no announcement. Okay, this is Elijah the Tishbite, and he's here to have a word with you, Ahab. Here's his credentials. Here's who he is. There's nothing. He shows up. And before he even opens up his mouth, there's a message that God has given him. And the message is simple: no rain until I speak again. There's no rain. You say, well, what's the big deal about that? That in Israel's economy was actually a devastating judicial sentence. That was severe mercy that God was pouring down on his people. Because without rain, there was no harvest. Israel was a country with no natural water. If you've ever been over there, you know that there's only one river in that entire nation. It's the River Jordan. There's only one large body of fresh water. You know it as the Sea of Galilee. Everything else is a spring. Everything else is a well. There is no natural water source in Israel except heaven. And in Deuteronomy chapter 11, God said to his people, I'm going to water the land for you. You don't have to worry about water. I'm going to take care of the water when you follow me. And when you follow me, I will give you early water. I will give you late water. I'll send the rains. And when the rains come, the earth will bear forth its precious fruit, its harvest, and you will eat until you are full. The idea there is that you will have so much abundance that you will be satiated. This is a Thanksgiving Day term. You know what I mean by Thanksgiving Day term? It's coming up. Some of you are already thinking that way. We got to get through October, and then we got to roll through November, and then comes the big day. This is the day when everybody, like, you diet for months ahead of time to earn points to spend on Thanksgiving Day. Or you get to Thanksgiving Day, and you promise yourself that you're going to diet for the next year based on what you plan to do. I mean, Thanksgiving Day is never accidental eating. Can we just acknowledge this? You're like, I ate more than I intended to. No, you didn't. You ate exactly how you intended to eat on Thanksgiving Day. You already know what's going to be on that table. It's not like you show up on Thanksgiving Day and there's a turkey and you're like, oh, where did that come from? I thought we were having lettuce, right? And then there's this awesome pumpkin pie with whipped cream, and you're like, oh, I thought we were having kale. Nobody is surprised when you walk into your house on Thanksgiving Day and there is this mountain of food. It's not a surprise to you. And you didn't get there by accident. It's like, oh, no, I was going to the gym. And then, no, you know why we don't go to the gym? Because they're closed. And you know why? Well, you know why they're closed on Thanksgiving? Because it's a law. Nobody goes to the gym on Thanksgiving. It's not workout day. It's eat up day so that the gyms can stay in business for the rest of the year. I think they have a collusion with Thanksgiving Day. I think it's like their favorite day of the year. I don't know how I got off on that anyway. God said, listen, I will send rain to the point that every day will be like Thanksgiving. You will be satiated with food. You will not be wondering, where am I going to get food? You're going to be wondering, what do I do with all this food? But if you follow other gods, I will dry up the rain. The heavens will be like brass. So it's not like Elijah just kind of walked in and thought, now what can I say to this guy that'll get his attention? You know, maybe I'll tell him about the army. Maybe it'll be the chariot thing. No. What am I going to do? That's not what he's doing. He has a very specific message that relates to a very specific part of the wisdom from above that God gave to his people. And it's Deuteronomy 11. And Elijah comes in and says, no more rain. And then he leaves. And 3.5 years pass. And there has been no rain. I mean, in the middle, you know, Ahab is so desperate, he gets his, like, chief of staff, a guy named Obadiah, who, by the way, is a faithful servant of the Lord, in the midst of all this wickedness, and he's hiding God's people, and he says to Obadiah, Obi, we gotta do something here. Because the horses are dying, and it was all about Ahab. The people are, you know, not, hey, Obadiah, what do you do? The people are, no, our horses are dying, and my military power is about to be impacted because of that, and so we got to go find water for the horses. I mean, this is Ahab. It's an economic disaster. The people are destroyed. People have died. The crops are ruined. And Baal is at the center of all this because he's the rain god. And God says to Elijah, I want you to go back to Ahab. And so Ahab is sitting in this pool of desperation, and Elijah comes back for round two, and he walks in the door, and the first thing that happens out of Ahab's mouth, you trouble Israel. You are the cause of all of this trouble. You ever notice when you go to somebody and you have something constructive you want to say to them, something that really will help them when they're about to make a mistake, and they turn on you and they just come right at you, and it's like, well, you're the cause of all this. It's your problem. This is exactly what Ahab did. We've all been there, haven't we? We go up to somebody like we're concerned. We have this burden we want to share with them because we're afraid that they're about to do something that's going to destroy them or people they care about or people we care about. And their first words out of their mouth is, you're the problem. That's exactly what Ahab did. Ahab may not be a pagan king, but he's acting like a pagan. He's looking right at Elijah, and he's saying, you are the problem. And Elijah comes right back, and he says, Ahab, actually, you are the one troubling Israel because you have wandered away from the statutes and the laws of God. Now, I want you to get all the prophets and all the priests and gather on Mount Carmel because God wants a word.
Thank you, Pastor Sam. We'll continue this sermon next time on Grow in Grace. Today's speaker, Dr. Sam Horn, is the pastor for preaching and vision at Palmetto Baptist Church. PBC meets at 2730 Anderson Road, Greenville, South Carolina. Join us for Sunday morning worship at 9 a.m. or 10:45 a.m. You can find us online at pbcpowdersville.org. If you have any questions about PBC, please email radio@pbcpowdersville.org. Thanks for listening. Join us again next time so together we can grow in grace.